welcome to Imperium Cast 5 with your hosts Joel and Mike here. We have another guest this week. We're excited to have him here. He's a very interesting guy. But first, let me get some housekeeping things out of the way before I introduce him. First of all, where to find us? You can find myself, Mike, editor-in-chief of Imperium Press, at imperiumpress.org. You can find Joel, editor-in-chief of Firstness, at firstness.org. And you can follow us on all the usual social media sites, Twitter, Telegram, Gab, and so on and so forth. We'll post some links in the description. Now, without further ado, let me introduce our guest, John David Ebert, a cultural critic, a poet, author of dozens of books. I had a look into this. You're unbelievably prolific, so it's great to have you on here. He has a well-known YouTube channel with very, very high-quality commentary. His Beowulf series was excellent. I had a look through the whole thing. I think it's like 14 parts. It's really comprehensive and good, and everybody should go check that out after this video. Give him a subscribe. He produces excellent content. We're excited to talk to him. So the topic today is, of course, on Beowulf. It's a kind of a rare discussion of a single book here on the Imperium Cast. We usually keep these Imperium Casts more topical than book discussion related. But of course, from time to time, we will bring those in. What's kind of driving this is that we at Imperium Press have released a new edition of Beowulf, so you can just go check that out at imperiumpress.org. As with all our titles, we're actually giving away the ebook for free. Usually we wait about a month to do that, but we're giving it away early this time because we're trying to solicit reviews on Amazon for it and drive that up so that it's the number one hit on the Amazon search for Beowulf. If I do say so myself, it's an excellent edition. The translation is by Francis Gumera, and it's in alliterative verse, and we'll talk a little bit about what that means. It's got Facing Old English and a number of other West Germanic poems that also have Facing Old English, and in one case, Old High German. It has a based and red-pilled foreword by Aidan McClear, who is a sort of right-wing Chad man about town that everyone should also check out. And it's got all the usual extras you'll expect from an Imperium Press Western Canon title. You know, things like genealogies, maps, glossaries of terms and names and all that stuff. So it's an excellent edition. Check it out. You can download it for free, or if you want, you can buy it as well in a hard copy. So to introduce Beowulf, I kind of want to do something a little bit different from what we normally do in the introductions. And I actually want to offer a personal story, and then I'll hand it over to John. So as a kid, you kind of have those stories that stick with you and shape who you are. I can remember reading two books at about age 13 or 14, something like that, that really changed who I would become forever. One of those was Darwin's Origin of Species, and the other one was The Hobbit. Now, Darwin obviously doesn't really enter into the discussion, but Tolkien, for me, stands like a giant, casting a long shadow over who I would become. Reading Lord of the Rings was kind of like, if you know that medieval woodcut, I don't know what it's called, but it's got the man who sort of like pulls the veil of reality aside and looks behind the appearances of things. He kind of sees like a whole other world behind there. It was hard to imagine as like a 13-year-old boy or thereabouts that somebody could have built such a convincing world as Tolkien did. And the world building wasn't confined just to the, you know, the huge number of characters and places or the lore. I mean, you read Lord of the Rings for the first time, and the mythology, the deep history, the old lays and songs, even just the names of the characters and places, then the sense of place and setting, all of this is, it just seems realer than real, as though it kind of, you know, like stands in a kind of mythic relation to the real world, what Christopher Tolkien called the primary world, as opposed to his father's, quote, secondary world. And you know, the world outside your doorstep kind of seems like this degraded and less colorful Middle Earth once you discover this secondary world. And anyway, flash forward something like 20 years later, and I just happened to pick up the cheap Penguin edition of this book called Beowulf that I'd heard of. And you start reading it, and like not three lines in, you just immediately understand where Tolkien came from. It was like reading the oldest lay in the Silmarillion. And you go on reading and you discover this whole world that surrounds this book, the whole universe of archaic Germanic literature that moves in this sort of North Sea orbit. You discover the Eddas, the Norse sagas, the Nibelungenlied, the Arthurian legends, the Mabinogion. And then you really understand what a deep and ancient tradition Tolkien was pulling from. There's the very good reason why he's so legendary. And it's more ancient than even he knew, and that's something that we may get into as well. So if you read Beowulf, Völuspá, the Volsunga Saga, you'll have half of Tolkien basically right there. So that's just to set it all up. As for the poem itself, I'll just kind of set this up briefly before I throw it over to John. Beowulf, of course, an ancient Germanic poem in alliterative verse. Tolkien has it as written probably roughly around the year 700, maybe a couple of generations after conversion to Christianity. But doubtless, I mean, much of the marrow of the poem is much older. And the alliterative verse is really important. It's not like rhymed couplets that we're used to in ballad measure. It's not even quite like quantitative meter, like Shakespeare's iambic pentameter, with a fixed number of syllables per line. Each line of Old English poetry has a series of four stressed syllables, and it could have like any number of unstressed syllables, and each line's broken into two half lines. And the pattern's actually based on alliteration, not the actual rhyming. So the, quote, rhyming, so to speak, of the initial consonants of the words. And each line's based on the alliteration of some consonant across the half line, so the first and second half of the line. So the four stress syllables, one of the first and two, first two and one of the last two has to alliterate. For example, you get something like, "For he waxed under welkin, and wealth he throve, till before him the folk, both far and near, who housed by the whale path, heard his mandate, gave him gifts, a good king he." So that's an example of what it sounds like. Now, the reason I mentioned the alliterative verse is that the large-scale structure of the poem kind of recapitulates this bipartite structure of the line itself. As a story, Beowulf is at least two stories. It's the first, the story of the young Geatish or Swedish hero who comes to the hall of his Danish kinsmen, slays two monsters. The second is the story of Beowulf in old age, a king in his own right who does battle with a dragon, mortally wounded, and dies with a kind of like note of sorrow at the transitoriness of human accomplishment. And what I think is significant here, and I'll just kind of touch on it, is the parallelism between the two halves of the story. You have the rising and setting sun of Beowulf himself, the two halves of life, the cyclicity and the Germanic reckoning of time. And Beowulf is this kind of liminal threshold between the old Germanic world of the deep past and the new Christian world. So this duality is at the heart of the story, and it's a sort of match between the narrative duality and the structure of the line itself, with the two halves echoing each other, kind of an as above, so below thing. So now, without going any further into that, I just want to hand things over to John. Thank you very much for joining us here, John.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, Beowulf is one of my all-time favorite works of literature. I would rank it up there with the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is probably my favorite of all time. And it was interesting because I grew up reading Beowulf, as did I think most people, it's just a simple adventure story. And Robert Zemeckis translates it into that in his very sort of vulgar version of it as just a simple adventure tale, a dragon slayer story, nothing more to it than that. But actually, when I sat down a few years ago to give it a very careful reading, because I remember sitting down and giving it a superficial rereading and then saying, hey, wait a minute, that's actually really complex what he just did there. And then I started digging into it. Then I grabbed Tolkien's recently then published book on it. He had been famous for doing the famous The Monster and the Critics lecture that he gave, where he stood up for the dragon. Everybody else thought the dragon was superfluous. And he's like, no, the dragon's the whole point. He has to kill the dragon. This is a warrior hero story. It's not history. This is an epic. These are the things that you find heroes doing in epics, particularly Scandinavian heroes, who are generally lone wolf type characters, which is one of the main points of Beowulf, that he is a lone wolf figure, as are many of the Scandinavian warrior heroes, especially in the poetic Eddas, where we have Siegfried, who's a classic example of another lone wolf hero. These are heroic men who want to brag about their deeds, and they don't particularly want to share them around. That's part of the contest they have when Beowulf and his 14 rather superfluous men that he brings with him into the hall, and they have this sort of contest the bragging contest about him having that swimming contest with Brekka, sort of the whole point of the mentality. Except that the interesting thing about the unknown and unnamed Beowulf, maestro, whoever he was Christian, but this guy knew Scandinavian mythology very, very well. He knew it like the back of his hand. And he brings to it a sense of irony that you don't find in the other Anglo-Saxon works of the time. Now, Beowulf is really it's the first great work of Western literature. As far as I'm concerned, it's certainly the first great work of English. You can see the English language coming into being within it, even though it occurs since about shortly after the Christian conquest, right about, which is 600 in there, AD, right about 700, the text starts springing up. Caedmon's hymn, for instance, the Battle of Maldon, but a lot of Christian texts, such as the Elena and the Genesis A text, and the Andreas, and most of these texts have picked up influences from Beowulf. Scholars can detect that. So we're pretty sure that, as you say, Mike, that the text was composed right around 700-ish, right in there, about 100 years after the Christian conquest, although it's set in a historical period dating from about 200 years earlier, about 500. Not that Beowulf is historical, of course, but most of the characters around him have been historically verified, such as Hrothgar and Hugleik and all of these other people. So we get the contest, and we get this idea that, unlike these other works, let's say the Battle of Maldon, or the fragment that you find that turns up in Beowulf, the Battle of I forget it now, the Battle of Friesburg, Finnsburg, the shop that the storyteller retells. And it's interesting to compare those two, because we only have a fragment of the Battle of Finnsburg, but it's a heroic celebration of the heroic deeds of Finn and who's a Frisian fighting the Danes. But then the way the shop tells the same thing in Beowulf, now there's a hint of irony. First of all, he switches the point of view from the warriors to the girl, the Brunhild type girl, who's, I think her name is Hildeburh. It switches to her point of view, which you wouldn't expect to happen. And what this guy does is brings in a sense of irony regarding this sort of Scandinavian Viking lone wolf warrior mentality. And you see him cast a critical, ironic eye on this. So it doesn't turn out to be the way Robert Zemeckis presents it, let's say, as this hero, this guy's a great hero, full of testosterone. He's like the old, you know, the Anglo-Saxon version of Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger or something. That's not right. This guy completely undermines Beowulf's deeds at almost every step, with very careful foreshadowing, very careful mirroring of events. And he basically ends up, you've got this heroic part where he cuts off Grendel's arm, Hrothgar gives him all his treasure, then he has to go and find Grendel, kill the mother. What a great man, what a great warrior. Except that when we get 50 years later to the last third of the epic, we get to this whole thing about the dragon. He's too old to be doing this, for one thing. He's in his 70s by this point. And he goes out to kill the dragon by himself, except he has a sidekick. And the gold that he gets is gold that has been cursed. And the implication from the Beowulf author is that in going out and doing this, not getting help, but in upholding this sort of hyper-masculine, lone wolf Viking mentality, it leads to the extinction of the Geats, the people that he is the last king of. And it's, as Tolkien points out, it's a significant fact that Beowulf does not have any issue. So he has no offspring. So he represents a terminal point there. And of course, he's a fictional character, although his father Ecgtheow may have more likely been the last of the Geats, who are then absorbed by the Swedes. And so it is kind of a twilight of the gods. It is a Götterdämmerung. It's just filled with irony and literary artistry. And it's, the artistry of it is so complex. It reminds me of like an Anglo-Saxon James Joyce. I mean, the guy is incredibly complex the way he tells the story. So that's what I would say as a kind of opening salvo.
Okay, so that's interesting. So it seems like what you're saying is that, in a sense, it's kind of announcing the end through this kind of ironic completion of this cultural type that Beowulf represents, you know, where he has no children, like you say. He does something ironically stupid, because, of course, as soon as the men get back after he slays the dragon and he's killed or whatever, then everyone gets pissed off, like, oh, well, why'd you guys abandon him? Now word's going to get around. People are going to attack us because they're going to think that you're all pussies, basically, because you didn't back up your guy. He's like a 7-year-old man. You let him fight a dragon by yourself and run off, like, except for like one other guy or whatever. And so they're all very concerned towards the end. I found this to be quite interesting because you have this contrast. You know, obviously the author is Christian and he's announcing the end of paganism, because I believe earlier in the story, when he has to fight Grendel, the people are attempting to engage in pagan rituals as opposed to a Christian prayer or something, where they're failing, and then Beowulf shows up. He has more of a Christian mentality, and so he's successful. And so in a way, at the beginning, there's this idea that, at least that I picked up, that Beowulf is kind of representing a newer type. You have this contrast between good and evil, where Beowulf is this very honorable character. He has many cases where he demonstrates quite an honorable, he makes a very honorable decision, where he gets the treasure. He makes sure he distributes it among his men and to his own king, according to like the proper customs. He humbles himself in victory while everyone's praising him and bestowing gifts upon him. And when Higelac dies, he refuses to take the kingship because his son Heidred is still alive, and then only after Heidred dies does he agree to, you know, become king. So he has like all of these moral qualities. So you have this moral contrast where Grendel is just pure evil. Obviously, there's like the lineage back to Cain. It's very different than something like the Iliad, where people are kind of like playthings of the gods, and the gods don't necessarily represent this clean binary good and evil distinction, but it's amalgam of anti-heroes, I guess, by like modern literary standards. But it's prior to even thinking in those terms, I guess, it'd be a projection from our culture back onto Homeric Greece to even like see it in those terms. But there does seem to be this transition. So I'm curious, John, like how you kind of see that all coming together, not just in Beowulf, but in the beginnings of early seeds of Anglo-Saxon civilization.
Well, I mean, it is a classic example. It's nothing unique to Europe. It's a classic example that happens all over the place when you get an incoming population. Let's say the famous Indo-Aryan, Indo-European invasions. We get Indo-Aryans coming down into India, Vedic India, and there's a native aboriginal population there that's been there forever, and they have their own myths. The Harappan civilization, one of those central myths that they have or practices is, of course, yoga, which everybody's in agreement on is native to India. It wasn't brought in by the Indo-Aryans. There's no evidence for it in the Rig Veda whatsoever, and neither is there any evidence for reincarnation and karma. That cluster of ideas comes up out of the native population. So we get this incoming, let's say, sign regime, to borrow a term from Deleuze and Guattari from their book A Thousand Plateau. You get an incoming sign regime, and you have this native sign regime. And at first, the incoming sign regime brings in this attitude of what is called in Scandinavian landnama, land naming and claiming. The new population comes in. They bring their myths with them. Let's say the Spaniards go into the Aztec world, and there's three trees on that hill over there. Now it's renamed the hill of New Golgotha, let's call it. So there's this land naming and claiming, and the new population brings in a new sign regime. But then there's always a reverse process of what's called acculturation, whereby the native situation, the native people who have had a sign regime that's been there much longer, slowly, gradually begin to digest the upper crust that has come in. These are different strata of symbols. And over time, the native sign regime, the myths and symbols start making their way up. And pretty soon after the Rig Veda and the Brahmanas, now we get the Upanishads, which is a different matter. Now we have Yojnavalkya, who is the teacher of yoga, reincarnation, and karma now. So the native population is, so now we're getting a cultural fusion and hybridization. In the case, though, of Beowulf, we have a similar process, but in a way it's reversed. We have the native population there with this whole Scandinavian myth world that this Christian author knew that's been there forever. Let's say Tacitus, Germania, back to 60 AD is the earliest account of German myth that we have. So it's been there at least that long, probably longer. And so we get the Christian overlay. The Christian sign regime comes in and overlays Europe, overlays the Frankish world first, and then, of course, England. And then Beowulf then represents a snapshot of this process where the two are in process of meeting and amalgamating, and it looks like Christianity is going to gobble this up and win, which for a while it does. The Scandinavian world converts late, not till about 1000 AD. So they quite very hurriedly write down the poetic Eddas before those disappear. But then, of course, over time, the acculturation process takes place when we get the Arthurian romances, circa 1200 or thereabouts, where now we get a fusion of Celtic mythology. Almost all the Arthurian legends are based on Celtic heroes, now fusing together with Christian myth, the idea of Joseph of Arimathea bringing that cup, you know, over, and that becomes the Grail in some versions. In other versions, it's the Philosopher's Stone. But there is a fusion there and an acculturation process whereby the Grail myths are a fusion, which is a little more not so much the way it is in Beowulf, where we're seeing the pagan native regime disappearing. But here with the Celtic and Arthurian romances, it's thrusting back up. It's moving back up through the surface in a very assertive way. And so in the West, we have had this sort of uneasy situation with at least two different sign regimes here. There are others, Arabic influences coming up through Spain and so forth. There are other sign regimes. But that's how I see the situation with Beowulf.
That's interesting that you mentioned the acculturation process. I think that's a good thing to bring in here. And of course, this is, as you mentioned, it happened with Vedanta in India, which is much less Aryan than the original strata of the Rig Veda. And it happened in Greece and Rome, of course. It's almost a historical law that the more complex culture, it sort of imposes itself on the less complex culture, but then eventually that process is kind of reversed, and then you have a bit of a sort of a synthesis. And this, of course, it happened in the Germanic Christian world as well. And you can see it in Beowulf, as you mentioned. There's a kind of a snapshot there where you get this strange feeling of incongruity in passing from ideas that were born out of the dark forests of ancient Germany to ideas born in the plains of Judea. Really that's surprising when we think about it, that one poet could kind of hold both ideas in his head at the same time. I mean, after all, the Teutonic chieftains have been doing this for like a century before him. They needed to get the best out of both their warrior aristocrats and their Latin clerks. And so many great Christian men whose recent ancestors were pagans had this sense. You could think of Charlemagne or Theodoric the Great or Alfred or Saint Olaf or any of these guys. They all collected and loved the ancient lays of their fathers. They all took direction from clerics, whether foreign or domestic, and they had to carry out this synthesis. So in a sense, it's kind of not that surprising to see it in the poem. But I think it's – we do have to be a bit careful about like announcing sort of the like reading Beowulf as the announcement of the end of the old world. We have to be careful about reading too much of that into the poem, because you think that scholarship in Beowulf scholarship has changed radically in the last 100 or 150 years. It used to be that it was considered almost an entirely Teutonic poem. With very little, like there was a famous essay called The Christian Coloring in Beowulf that kind of sums up in a sentence what the attitude was. Then around World War I, you get a big sea change, against the Germanic interpretation, and around leading up to World War II, you get yet another, sea change kind of moving in the same direction. There's a lot of elements in it that are Christian, of course. You get the genealogies, the Christian genealogies of Cain. Mostly the genealogies are actually in the villains like Grendel and whatnot. But the poem doesn't have any reference to Christ or the cross or the saints or the atonement or anything like that. But there's constant evidence of old belief in giants and elves and fate and wergild and pagan burial customs and everything like that, which is not to say that it's necessarily a primarily pagan poem, just to say that the Beowulf poet really knew his Germanic lore very, very well and loved it. And I think it's important to remember who he was writing or composing for. when you get this sort of like welter of episodes and allusions to other tales, it's very confusing, actually. It's not like Iliad. It's not a sort of straightforward of narrative that moves from one thing to the next. There's all these digressions. And in part, this is just because the original audience, which mostly consisted of noble patrons, mostly of the warrior class, would have been familiar with the allusions. But it's also because the Beowulf poet was expected to do this. So many episodes have little or nothing to do with the plot or the characters of Beowulf himself. And these episodes seem to have been introduced into the poem with the intention of making it into a kind of encyclopedia of Germanic antiquities, like details of the royal houses, not just of the Geats and the Danes, but also the Swedes and the Angles and the Ostrogoths and the Frisians and the Heathobards and all this. And references to like the deeds of Sigmund and everything like that. This is something that the poet was expected to do because his audience demanded it of him. But he does have a unique voice. This is not exactly a Indo-European epic. There is a difference. The Christian world has come in and made a sort of change here. The Beowulf does it in a peculiar way, kind of unlike Homer. He mixes narrative with comment. I think this is something that both you, John, and Joel had both mentioned. Like he praises, he blames, he makes moral examples out of his characters. There's so much internal life to them that's not in Homer. You think of maybe Julian James's bicameral man here. Like Grendel's mind laughs when he happens upon the sleeping warriors. Hrethel's grief at the accidental death of his son. This is described at length in a way that you would not really get out of a Homeric poem. There's a lot of moralizing. Hrothgar goes on a long homily on the greedy king. And we even get a sort of taste of the poet himself. There's a kind of note of sadness or world weariness in the poem, a regret for the past, but also a sort of like looking forward to the future. And this is more the case in the first than the second half of the poem, when Beowulf is young and full of vigor. It's a bit strange because you'd think that there's more call for it in the second half when he's an old man, but then the dragon is kind of less a character than a force of nature. So to moralize over that is kind of like moralizing over an avalanche or something. But Grendel and his mother are closer to human, so the poet kind of sketches out the moral dimensions more fully there. I'm just wondering, John, what do you think about the actual narrative voice of the poem? How does it differ from some of the other epics that you've read, like Gilgamesh, for example?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Mike, actually, that there is a kind of personality to this guy. It's too bad we don't know who he is, his name, because his personality does come through quite a bit. In a way, say, if you try to read the poetic Eddas, there's not much personality. In the lays and songs of the poetic Eddas, they're quite a bit different. So there's a definite, this guy has a take. He makes sarcastic comments. And as I was saying before, he's very ironic, in a lot of the recountings of these deeds of Beowulf and company. That does come through quite a bit. I do want to point out though, with regard to the Twilight of the Gods motif here, which I see in, Beowulf kind of all over the place. One of the other comparisons though, to that is when Beowulf goes out to fight the dragon, the two sort of annihilate each other, in very much the way that during Ragnarok, Thor and the Midgard serpent annihilate each other. The Fenris wolf, a whole bunch of characters just sort of wipe each other out, almost like particles colliding at the end of time and history. And the universe ends in a conflagration in the Ragnarok, just as, I love the contrast. There's a lot of contrast. When the boat of Skjaldsheffin first shows up in the opening lines, and then the Danes' first great king, and then they bury him at sea and send the boat back out too. So he has this death by water. And then with Beowulf at the end, they, of course, burn his body. So there's that burning motif again. And also the idea that Beowulf goes out to meet his weird, which is one of the earliest occurrences of the concept of the Germanic, Scandinavian conception of fate as weird, as something that is unique to you. It comes out of this very lonely. Oswald Spengler in The Decline of the West has this great point where he says the characters of Faustian literature are the loneliest characters in history. The Homeric world doesn't have this. The characters in the Homeric world are all plugged into social formations. They all sort of relate to each other. They're embedded within groups with each other. They're in discussion all of the time. But this idea of the lonely Germanic warrior's days seem to be numbered in this epic, and also in the Song of Roland. The Song of Roland is the first great sort of French work of literature that in many ways bears a certain number of comparisons to Beowulf because, and it was written about 1000, which is the same time that the scribes are finally copying down Beowulf from wherever the source is that they're getting it. About 1000, and it's written about the time of the Norman invasion, right in there, 1066. But it's about set in the time of Charlemagne, in which Roland is this character. They've been fighting in Spain against the Moors, and they're retreating now. They're leaving. Roland holds up, together with his sidekick Oliver, holds up the rear guard. And then he is betrayed by Roland's stepfather, who goes to the Moors and tells him, hey, I know a way that you can trap Roland. He's got a very small group with him. So he takes him up on it. And he goes, and Oliver says, hey, blow your horn, the Olifant, as it's called, blow your horn so we can get some help from Charlemagne. He'll hear us. And Roland says, we're not doing that. That's cowardice. We're going to do this ourselves. So once again, he's upholding this sort of Viking, and there were Germanic influences on this epic. This is a Norman Franco epic. And he's saying, we're doing this ourselves. That would be an act of cowardice and shame. We'll never live it down. And Oliver says, well, all right, I'm with you here, but I don't think it's a smart thing to do. So then, indeed, they go through the battle. They get their asses pretty much kicked. And then at the last minute, Roland says, okay, I'll blow the horn. Then Oliver disagrees and says, well, why blow it now? It's a little late. He does blow it anyway, and he blows it so hard that his head basically collapses, and that's it for poor Roland. But it clearly, the anonymous author here, and here again we have an anonymous author, is clearly paying farewell to this Viking lone wolf mentality, the lone wolf, the lonely warrior, at the expense of the group, at the expense of the people that Roland was with, the other soldiers, is a thing that has seen its day and is on its way out as we move slowly up into the age of the troubadours. And it's a whole different world with them. So I see this this paying farewell of this Victorian, or rather Viking mentality of the lone wolf, with his great deeds, in both authors, both are very skeptical about it. So I would add that.
It's interesting that you say that there is this announcing of the end of this lone wolf archetype, because to me, I mean, I see this, I mean, I'm not as anywhere near as well versed in like the history of myth and literature as you. So I'm more embedded in the context in which I grew up, which is like the last, you know, the 20th century basically, and a more contemporary culture. And I see that archetype all over, like in just Hollywood movies, pretty much every action film, with like Bruce Willis in it or something, for example, he's like this lone wolf, you know, tough guy who won't ask anyone for help. And that seems to be still what resonates with us, is like, this is essentially what heroism is. And also the notion of being determinative over one's own fate, that fate is a product of our own decisions at critical points based on the strength that emanates from the individual. This also seems to be this essential feature of our culture that underlies, particularly in Anglo-Saxon culture, this intense love of freedom, so to speak, or liberty, and like respect for the self-made man, taking pride in being in control over one's own destiny, and all of this kind of stuff. So, like you were saying before, how you said these earlier narratives seem to be ironic critiques of this mentality, ushering in some Christian influence, then you come forward and you were talking about the Arthurian myths or what have you. It's almost like once Christianity gets established, then the pagan lineage starts then asserting itself up through the back door in more subtle ways. And I've heard you talk about this before, how, you know, whenever a culture is overcoded by some other system, you know, it gives the impression that it's been kind of wiped out, but then it will always like express itself through it in some new way down the track. You bring up one of your favorite examples, how Native American culture expresses itself through comic book stories in the United States and so forth. So, I mean, I feel like that'd be interesting to kind of get your take on.
Yeah, this is an early phase of this process, and Christianity may have had something to do with this. After all, Roland is a Christian hero, and the author of Beowulf is Christian, which tends to bring in a more collective group-like emphasis. But as Spengler says, Christianity is a pseudomorphosis on the West. It's a false formation that's totally at odds with this idea of the individual as a metaphysical species unto himself, which doesn't really fit that well with Christianity, in which we hear, you know, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. Because the idea there, the political, socioeconomic sort of idea, is that consensus. Consensus is what binds us together in all of the various Magian religions. And so this archetype, though, of the lone wolf, nevertheless becomes the primary Faustian archetype, like Spengler says. Our characters, Hamlet, King Lear, Don Quixote, all the way down to Michael Corleone, these are the loneliest characters in the history of literature. And so the lone wolf idea, you're right, it goes all the way down into our popular culture as the true and authentic myth of the West. Nonetheless, despite the fact that these Christian authors are trying to de-escalate it, de-emphasize it, and say, well, we're really part of a group here. But then this is at the birth of feudalism. It's a different organization than the age of these lone, magnificent warriors. So society is organizing itself into collectivities at this time, getting off the ground with, you know, the churches and the rituals and the feudalism. So it has to be taken into that context, the context of that particular epoch. It's not exterminated by any means. No, I mean, I agree with you on that.
I thought of something kind of interesting, which might be a bit of a detour, but I was talking to someone the other day. I can't honestly remember who it was to give them credit for this insight, where he was talking about how you see in the traditional, the old school classic mafia movie, you have always some gangster who does morally questionable things, but then they turn up to confession because they're, you know, they're usually Italian or something. And so they have this Catholic overlay that underlies their character. You know, some people perceive it as like ironic, but nevertheless, they seem to take it seriously. And so that creates a kind of moral depth in the character. Okay, well, then they still have a process of confessing their sins. They still have some relation to divinity that underlies what they do. And this gives them a moral texture so that they don't just come across as this vulgar, self-interested figure, but they actually, they have this complex responsibility to their family, to divinity, and so forth that contextualizes their decisions. Whereas then you come forward to The Sopranos, which is probably the last great attempt at articulating this motif. And instead, but you get all of these scenes towards the end of The Sopranos where he's going to see like a shrink or like a psychologist.
Yeah.
And the psychologist, instead of the priest, makes his character a little bit more pathetic, where now he is giving up ground. Like, there's this one really good scene where he's pissed off at one of his guys came out as gay, and he's like, I can't have him around the construction site anymore, so to speak, using the euphemism. All the guys are going to, you know, think he's a fag. They're not going to want to work with him. And this female psychologist is trying to make him feel guilty. And then he starts kind of like questioning his own worldview, and it makes his character kind of pathetic. Like, he loses his masculine edge and becomes integrated into this progressive cultural mentality of accept everyone, this collectivizing mentality. And so it's kind of interesting, like, I get what you're saying about Spengler's critique of Christianity as being this collectivizing impulse, but at the same time, obviously in Christianity, your sins are forgiven at the level of the individual. Your relationship to divinity is primarily through the sacraments you as an individual enter into, and you're judged as an individual. If your father is not a Christian, that doesn't mean you can't become one, or responsibility apexes on the individual. So there is a certain way that those two things can be fit together, which is why they have been, also at the same time, not necessarily.
Yeah, perhaps. It might be interesting to think of Toynbee's distinction between Northern Europe and Southern Europe in the light of this a bit, because psychiatry is really a sort of Protestant invention out of the North. It's an equivalent, let's say, morphologically to the Father Confessor, which I do think is a more collective endeavor, as opposed to the North, with the psychiatrist speaking directly to, let's say, a Jungian analyst, in the sense in which he says that, Toynbee says that the North is Promethean and the South, let's say south of the Rhine, is Epimethean. France and Italy and Spain are still Mediterranean. They're still beholden to the old collective forms of the Mediterranean world. There's still that pseudomorphic overlay over that world, whereas the North is not. The North is Promethean. It's forward thinking. And the myth of the individual is something that really comes into being more north of the Rhine than I think south of the Rhine. It's there in both because it is one civilization, but I think it's a matter of degree of emphasis there. And so it's interesting that you bring up Tony Soprano shifting from, you know, the classic mode of the Godfather with these ancient southern Mediterranean, you know, Catholic forms that organized this mafia world to this shift, to this backyard suburban mafia guy, shifting to psychoanalysis as his primary father confessor. And it's a wonderful irony because you're right. It does sort of undermine his power over time. As the episodes go along, you kind of sense your mafia archetype is in disintegration there. So worth thinking about. Absolutely. All of that.
It's a little bit problematized thinking of Christianity as just a purely sort of collective, collectivizing force on the West. You think of, say, the difference between shame versus guilt culture. This is a sort of dichotomy that came in about the mid-20th century, where you get like the guilt culture is essentially the culture of where the locus of moral identity is effectively internal. It's something between you and God, versus the shame culture, which where the locus of identity is essentially social. It's between you and the community. And I think that obviously the guilt culture is more of a Christian sort of thing. The shame culture is more of a pagan thing, for lack of a better term. But at the same time, I think Spengler also brings in a good point where that there is a kind of a Promethean, in a way, a Promethean sort of underlay to the pagan world and the Aryan world more broadly, going back thousands of years. So this lone wolf in the form of Beowulf. And I think that the name is not accidental here. These things never die, right? Like the rugged individualist is a sort of idea that's come back, in time. And there is a Faustianism to it that's come back at sort of the end of the Faustian cycle. You get it in the Western, as you mentioned, like with Clint Eastwood and Blood Meridian and these things. And this all comes out of the sort of backcountry people from the Scottish borderlands that like form the ethnogenesis of the people, from, if not necessarily the deep south, but the backcountry, what became sort of the old West and whatnot. And there's a bit of an Aryan spirit in there as well. And you get this in the poem too, like Beowulf itself, in the warp and weft of the language itself, where you get these verbal constructions that are of extreme antiquity. You get this odd verbal construction that is a sort of periphrastic verb phrase, to become the slayer to, meaning to kill. And it runs through all like Old English, Old Norse, Old High German, Old Saxon, and it's used in a very specific context in Beowulf to describe the extraordinary killings. And the interesting thing about it, without going too far into the linguistics, is that you get this weird formulaic phrasing also in Homer. So you get this formulaic phrase that is it's not really found outside of the Indo-European world, but it is found in the last – obviously the last common ancestor of the Germanic world and the Greeks, which is going back thousands and thousands of years. So you get these things, these elements that are very, very ancient, archaic in the extreme in Beowulf. We're dealing more than with just like a common phrase, but there's a common stock of ideas in here and expressions and a common worldview. And I think that this comes to the fore in the sort of fight to the finish at the end of Beowulf, as much as it's lamented by the poet as sort of the twilight of the gods. And I think that's actually a good way to describe it. You get the bale fire, the funeral pyre of Beowulf. That's a great kind of, mirror of the Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods at the end of time. And, Beowulf, he knows that he's going to die. He knows that, his hour has come, but he fights on anyway. And this is something that's sort of like, it's just part of that Aryan spirit that like runs through the poem. He knows that his fated hour is coming. He slays the dragon. He wins the gold for himself and the treasure for his people. Not because he has anything to gain, but because that's what the hero does. And I think that there are lessons here for us that like we can even learn today from this, 1300 year old poem.
Those are some good points. This is probably my criticism of Spengler it's kind of like typical for a German. He has this very deterministic perspective and he has this very rigid notion of identity. It's either Christianity is the basis, or Christianity would be an overlay. You can only think about these things in two ways. There has to be some authentic truth that would be expressing itself from below. You can't tolerate seemingly like maybe like a Deleuzian reading of history where you would have these things are being mixed together and it's not so much one and the other anymore, but the internal difference of these nonlinear connections between them that gives rise to something new as a mutation. I think this is probably more in line with the truth. So as you talk about all these different aspects of pagan culture or classical European culture, you know, it just made me think in Christianity, you have notions like the spirit conquering the flesh and the condition of the soul being more important than the condition of the body, obviously demonstrated through the life of Christ. And also the idea of Christ internalizes the law. As you were saying, there's like this moral internalization. So Jesus says, well, if you're married and you even think about fucking someone else, you might as well have committed adultery, because it's like the condition of your heart is what he's concerned with more so than just whether you actually follow it through. So as far as society is concerned, they don't really care what you're thinking as long as you don't do anything. Whereas Christianity has this even more intense emphasis on the actual will itself, like what do you actually will? So I think all of these themes actually fit quite interestingly in with this notion of the lone wolf. You know, the story that John brought up earlier, I can't remember the guy's name, where he, you know, blows the horn, ironically, as he's just about to die. And the act of blowing the horn kills him. And it's kind of like, man, why'd you blow the horn? You could have gone out like a boss. No, I'm not blowing the horn. I'm not a bitch. You know, I sort my own shit out and I'll die on the battlefield if necessary. And so you can at least die with honor. But then in blowing the horn, he doesn't just die physically, but almost spiritually he dies. And that's, I guess, represented by the act actually being the thing that kills him, as opposed to anything else, because it's a denigration then of his spirit and his whole ethos.
Yeah. It's interesting, this idea that every time I think about Middle Eastern culture forms, I do tend to think of them as tribal, as coming out of tribal worlds. The Hebrews obviously come out of tribal nomadic traditions. Everything is tribal. Tribes tend to be shame-based cultures, right? Even in gangs, even in street gangs, if you excel too much, you might become a problem for the rest of the group. And even think of Ibn Khaldun's philosophy in the Mukaddimah, where he analyzes, he's sort of like the Arabian Spangler, and he analyzes history in terms of different stages and sequences, but he privileges the tribe, the Bedouin tribe. And he says that the thing about the Bedouin tribe is that it has this kind of mystical glue called a sabia, which holds the tribe together and gives it this sort of power and purity of transmission of blood, which when civilization comes along, civilization tends to create decadence and spoils this mentality by dispersing the bloodlines and dispersing a sabia. So for him, civilization is already corrupt. It doesn't even need to go through a Spenglerian cycle of birth, floreza, and decline and death. For him, the whole thing is corrupt because it isn't tribal anymore. So I tend to see this tribal mentality that comes out of the Middle East is fundamentally shame-based anyway, and that in the North with Protestantism, I see that as guilt-based. As Mike says, it does come out of the sort of private inner moral conscience between you and God. So what do we need the priest for? We don't need the priest. So it's just between me, God, and the Bible. And I don't need a priest telling me what to think about the Bible. That in itself is a very fiercely individual sort of guilt-based mentality that I think does come out of the North. It's a direct genealogical descendant from the Scandinavian lone warrior.
Yeah, Mukaddimah is a brilliant, brilliant piece of work. Ibn Khaldun is someone that should be read by more of our guys. Absolutely. And I think that there's
two theories on it. I need to do it as serious.
Oh yeah, no, I would definitely watch that. It's great. It's also a huge work as well, but very much worthwhile. And I think that there's something to this idea that, you know, in the North you have this individuating kind of tendency that you don't have in the South. I think some of that has to do, it's hard to say, like what comes first, chicken or egg. You know, some of this might have to do with the fact that most of the what we think of as Southern Europe is on the far side of the Hajnal line. This is, you know, the line that separates the cultures in terms of nuptiality, in terms of their marriage practices. In a nutshell, this dichotomy being on the one side you have the nuclear family, on the other side you have the extended family. Does the family structure sort of create the conditions for the psychology, or does the psychology create the family structure? It's hard to say, but I think that that's part of it. And I think it's like one of the things that we should think of is that when Christianity came into Northern Europe, it changed things. Absolutely, it changed things. But it took a while for that to happen. You look at the like archaic forms, or like, you know, the older forms of Germanic Christianity, and they look very, very different from what came later. You look at Beowulf is the cardinal example here. Like if Beowulf is a Christian poem, and in many respects it is, it's a very odd Christianity that still makes room for, you know, the belief in giants, the belief in elves and fate and weird and all this stuff. Christianity took a while to actually change Germanic culture, and in some ways, you know, obviously one of the threads that runs through this discussion is that it was a synthesis. It was a sort of mutual change. And there's an interesting book called The Germanization of Early Medieval Christianity that goes into this, where when Christianity came north, it sort of originally, you know, the people who brought it in tried to bring it in its pure form, but it didn't really stick. So it had to be sort of changed, and Jesus had to be kind of retconned into this Drichten, like, you know, warrior aristocrat with his band of retainers as the apostles and everything, and changed very radically. And that is sort of our, like, as, you know, Anglos or as Germanics or, you know, Scandinavians, this is kind of our original Christianity. It looks a lot like Beowulf, and it sort of changed later on. And the question, I guess, you know, for, you know, Christian studies is, did it get more authentically Christian as it went along, or did it get less authentically Christian? It's kind of hard to say. But I my view on the matter is that originally that form of Christianity is kind of, that is the native Christianity to us. And what came later with Protestantism and everything was something a little bit different, that kind of changed things. But I think if, you know, there's a lot of sort of discussion that's sort of come around recently in the dissident right sphere about, you know, how can paganism and Christianity be made to fit together, because obviously they're two currents of our culture, and they always will be, and how can they fit together? I think Beowulf is it's a great example to point to of how these things can actually fit together. And well, I mean, if they can fit together, it is going to look something like Beowulf. So that's another lesson that the book has to teach us.
I was just going to ask you, Mike, do you know the text, the Heliand?
Yes, I'm very familiar with the Heliand, yeah, actually. That's an amazing book.
The whole time when you were saying about an earlier, more sort of Germanic, authentically Germanic version of Christianity, where it's sort of recast as Christ is this German tribal leader, and the disciples are like, you know, the members of his tribe. And it's and it uses Germanic references and
names.
It's great. And you barely even recognize it as, it's supposed to be like a German gospel. But yeah,
like
you're right.
There's the scene in the Garden of Gethsemane. Sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's the scene in the Garden of Gethsemane where, you know, where somebody's ear gets cut off. And the scene is hilarious because it's just like it turns into this almost like anime level, like over, like, you know, just the violence is dialed up to 11, and the cutting off of the ear becomes this like gushing head wound. And the Heliand, I hate to say that it's hilarious, because that sounds very sacrilegious to say about, you know, a scripture. And even Germanic pagans, they have great reverence for the Heliand, because it's one of the major forms of reconstruction of Old Saxon. But it is funny, like, to read this stuff. Like, and it's actually, it's also awe-inspiring as well, because it's sort of a way of, you know, it's the Bible cast into this alliterative verse that just, it's like the Bible cast into sort of Tolkien-esque language and everything. So that's another one. I think it's worth reading, especially for Christians, and especially for those Christians who want to recapture a kind of warrior mentality, going back to the Crusades and everything like that. So yeah, I'm glad you brought it up.
Okay, I think maybe we should bring the discussion to a close here, but maybe as one final subject to riff on what you guys were just saying, that I could kind of propose before we do that. Obviously, Christianity, it has this, you know, the way that the Bible's written and the audience that it's intended for at the time, it's obviously written directly for Jews and Greeks, basically, more or less. And so everything is narrated in the New Testament in light of its relation to the Old Testament, and then obviously the context of classical civilization. If you're trying to then take that 1,000 years later into a completely different culture, you would need to recontextualize the significance of what's going on there. So, I mean, that sounds quite valuable. But that is kind of the interesting dichotomy then, because Ebert made a good point about how Protestantism has this Promethean individualism, you know, I don't need a priest to tell me how my religion works. And there's this kind of Magian notion of the communal institution relating the individual to the divine member of a community rather than as an individual. And this gets overthrown by Protestantism. But then at the same time, Catholicism offers, because Catholicism doesn't have this fixation upon just the Bible, nothing but the Bible, it allows for there to be an elaboration through the last 2,000 years or whatever. Catholicism wasn't done yet, but when the Bible was written, then there's thousands of years of work of all these people trying to fit it into metaphysics, and there's all these different church fathers down through the last however long that have worked out all these theological questions, and all of this is very important too. I mean, even up to the day of where you have, you know, in the 20th century, you still have work being done on Catholicism in light of phenomenology and other different innovations and in philosophy. So it's this interesting contrast where on the one hand, Protestantism does kind of capture one aspect, but maybe loses the other, which is it loses the capacity to participate in continuing this tradition and complexifying it, as opposed to sectioning it off within the immediate vicinity of Christ and his apostles. That's where the story ends, and there's nothing else to really say about it, which you have this tendency, particularly in the more fundamentalist strains of Protestantism. So I'm curious to get, you know, your guys' view on this distinction.
Sure, yeah. I'll just actually keep my comments fairly short on this, but I think that one of the great strengths of, you know, Protestantism versus Catholicism, I'm just echoing Joel's point here, but I think one of the great strengths is that it has the idea that there is something left to do in interpreting Christianity and interpreting the past and interpreting our traditions. And like, you know, in the dissident right, there's a, you know, it's very heavily Catholic for the most part. Obviously, the Enlightenment came out of Protestantism. And so Protestantism is taken as cringe and blue-pilled or whatever you want to say about it. But the fact is that there have been really important and really, really just very chad, for a lack of a better word, Protestants in the past. You think of Robert Filmer or Thomas Carlyle and all these guys. There is not a hard and fast dichotomy between like Catholicism is based and Protestantism is not. And one of the things that I think is the strength of Protestantism is that it allows room for interpretation. There is an individuating aspect of it that I think is it goes too far. And I think that this obviously runs into sort of it runs off the rails into the sort of like every man his own king kind of thing that, like, you know, it sort of like culminates in like woke ideology and like the breakdown of all identity. But at the same time, it's something that is native to us as Indo-Europeans, as people who have come from a religious milieu in the original sort of sphere where each particular family had its own domestic religion, and that there was a kind of particularizing aspect to it. I think that that's important. I think that you can see that in Beowulf with the creative sort of reinterpretation of the Beowulf poet of the pagan past. And I think that it's something that really needs to be taken under consideration as we move forward and answer questions about who we are as a people and what our spirituality actually looks like. It needs to be something constructivist to an extent. So I'll just leave it there. And John, let's give you the last word on this.
Oh, sure. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I was just thinking about that. I like this idea that at least with Protestantism, with Protestantism, the negative side is you lose the beauty of the rituals. You lose the art that comes off the walls. And so you go to church. I grew up Protestant Lutheran, and I remember how boring the churches were on the inside. You just have to listen to this guy giving a boring sermon. Whereas when I got married, I married a Catholic woman, and I would go to church with her and just be blown away by the art all over the walls and the beauty of the sacrament It was absolutely stunning. But in the one case, you have dogmatic compliance. The priest is infallible, and the moral character of the priest makes no difference to the magical efficacy of the rites. He can be a degenerate pig. And this is one of the reasons why the Protestants rejected the priesthood, because the moral quality of the person matters. It matters. And this idea of leaving room for interpretation. And it kind of leads me to think of the way Jung handles dreams. In a certain sense, the whole thing is about interpreting dreams. He treats the psyche as a text. And he's, of course, comes out of the Protestant tradition as well. Whereas, interestingly, Freud is a Jew. Freud comes out of the Jewish tradition, not the Catholic, but they share a certain dogmatism. And with Freud's attitude, it has to be his way or it's the highway. And he's very dogmatic about it and doesn't leave much room for individual interpretation. His sexual theory is correct. His theory of the unconscious as a personal biographical unconscious is correct. And he was constantly trying to rein Jung in. And it's a little bit like them playing the role of Zeus in Prometheus and Aeschylus's Prometheus Unbound, where Zeus is trying to rein Prometheus in. And Prometheus basically says, fuck you. Zeus can do what he likes. He can go to hell for all I care. I'm going to bring the fire to humanity. And that attitude is replayed there in the dogmatism of Freud as a Jew and Jung coming out of the tradition of Protestant interpretation and reading dreams like books. And this replays itself even in contemporary modernist literature with James Joyce coming out of the Catholic tradition. And Joyce doesn't care if you understand what he's doing or not. He's like the Catholic priest with his back, classically with his back turned to the audience. I know it's different now. Pronouncing the rites in Latin. You don't need to understand the Latin. You don't need to know the Bible for it. All to be magically effective through the propagation of the mystical body of Christ through the group. Whereas Thomas Mann, coming out of the German tradition and studying Jungian psychology, and he definitely favored Jung over Freud, as he's going along, he's constantly telling you what the symbols mean in the Magic Mountain or in his reworking of Joseph and his brothers, the myth out of Genesis. And so it's interesting that these two traditions, I'm much less comfortable with the dogmatic tradition of Catholicism in the southern Mediterranean world, but nonetheless, I do appreciate its beauty. It's like, you know, the beauty of everything that comes out of the Mediterranean, whether it's Italian Renaissance art or Greek art, it's all stunning. It's unbelievable. Northern art, by comparison, maybe not as good, but there is all this freedom for individualistic interpretation. And so maybe there's a stream here that goes from Beowulf all the way down here into modernity.